Yes. Hope you enjoyed that. That was Tiha Bayatin by Tati. And here in the studio, I have with me Ibrahim Gamad. And I actually pronounced it right, hopefully.
Thank you for inviting me to the show.
Oh, you're most welcome. Thank you for coming in and telling us something about your journey to Rumi.
Yes.
Now, perhaps to start with, before we find out about you, tell us about Rumi and how he captured you and made you, well, made you, but brought you into his works.
Well, first of all, Jalaluddin Rumi was one of the most famous Persian mystic poets. He lived from 1207 to 1273. He was born in what is now Afghanistan, and ahead of the Mongol invasion of Central Asia, his family left and went toward the west, and they eventually settled in Anatolia, which is nowadays Turkey, in the city of Konya, which is where his father's grave is and Rumi's tomb is. And Rumi's descendants and companions. And that's all now a national museum. And I can say more about that later on.
Okay.
But Rumi was given an extraordinary education by his father, who was himself a great mystic. He studied Sufism for 9 years under his father's leading disciple, who taught him until he died. And soon, around the time that his first Sufi teacher died, his second and most significant Sufi teacher, Shamsi Tabrizi, arrived in Konya. And then that became a mystical, spiritual transformation for Rumi. And then he became an ecstatic and began composing poetry, ecstatic poetry, poetry containing great wisdom, spiritual wisdom.
Now, what was his back? How did he his knowledge base? How did he get to be to write? Is there
Well, he was given a traditional Muslim education. His first Sufi teacher sent him to Syria for a number of years, where he mastered Arabic and the standard fields of knowledge, and as well as continuing studying Sufism with the teacher when he came back for visits to Turkey. And he was prepared to be the successor of his father, who was a great mystic. And he must have known that he had poetic talent, because he must have studied the other earlier Persian Sufi mystics, that is, the mystics of Islam and their Persian poetry. And when he became ecstatic through contact with his second Sufi teacher, Shamsi Tabrizi, he began composing poetry, and he just couldn't stop. And the amazing thing is that 700 years later, well, his poetry was always famous and revered.
In
the East for centuries.
But even in his contemporary time.
Even in his contemporary time, yeah. Yes.
How was it disseminated, his work?
Well, there were scribes. I mean, first it was the Konya was the seat of the local Seljuk dynasty in that area. So he had the patronage of the local sultan, and who sought his advice, and his fame spread very quickly thereafter. And he was one of the most famous mystic poets for many centuries in Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, those countries for all those centuries, extremely revered. And by an amazing sequence of events, he became popular in America and Europe in the English language.
Yeah.
And that is an amazing outcome. It's been asserted that translations or popularized versions of Rumi's poetry are the best-selling poetry in America for years and years. It's been asserted. And I don't know how true that is, but he's very well known.
Yeah.
We had a meeting with our broker, and our broker began reciting something she had memorized of Rumi. So it's amazing how popular many people have heard of Rumi, or know that he's a poet that wrote poetry having to do with spiritual love, and the joy is especially appealing to Americans, I think.
Huh. Now did he? What language did he write in?
Persian. His native language was Persian.
Okay.
But he also wrote many Arabic poems. Also, but maybe 10% in Arabic. Yeah.
Okay. So, and when were the earliest translations of his work into Western languages?
Well, going back into mainly the 1800s, the more significant ones, and the most complete and accurate translation was done in the 30s. By a British scholar named Nicholson, translated the entire, what's called Masnavi, Masnavi, which is his greatest work of Sufi stories and Sufi wisdom. And that was the work that he spent the last years of his life on, and his great masterpiece. And so that... Then he wrote also thousands of ecstatic, what were called ecstatic poems.
And were they, what sort of length are his poems when you say a poem?
Well, the Masnavi is in rhymed couplets, and there are just, maybe there's six books, and each book has maybe 4,000 couplets. And then he wrote 3,000, what are called, popularly called ecstatic poems, that are devoted to his spiritual master.
And who was his spiritual master?
The second Sufi teacher, Shamsi Tabrizi.
Oh, okay.
He was in an ecstatic state where he was merging with his Sufi master. So in a mystical state where he saw or described poetically the beauty of his master in the stars and the sun and the nature and the beauty of the sky and heavenly metaphors. It's part of the, in Sufism, is understood as merging or annihilation of the ego in the spiritual presence of the master. Then that leads to the next stage, which is annihilation or spiritual merging in the consciousness of the Prophet Muhammad. And then finally it's called annihilation in God alone. So I think that's the best way of explaining his ecstatic poems and why they had often end with a mention of his master's name, Shams, which means the sun, and many puns on the sun. And usually in these poems, the author of the poem is mentioned at the end of the line. So he, being practicing egolessness, he would end with the name of his teacher.
Oh, okay. Get some brownie points there, yeah.
And he also wrote some 2,000 quatrains. And that's a book that I spent with an Afghan scholar. He and I spent 22 years on when I met him in 1985. And that is this book, The Quatrains of Rumi, which I'm holding here for you to see.
And that's a big tome.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we spent all those years in our spare time, of course, working on that. And it's bilingual in Persian and English and has explanations. And that's the other type of poem that he wrote, the quatrains, which are four lines each. About 2,000 of those. And so how I got involved is your second question.
Right.
Well, I had a profound mystical experience in my sophomore year of college of the transcendent oneness of the universe. I experienced for a few hours that although everything appears obvious to us as separate objects, I felt that there was a transcendent oneness at the same time. And that there was one consciousness. I felt that it was infinite, it's presence was infinite, and there was I felt that I was in an ocean of love. I felt literally that I loved my neighbor as myself, because my neighbor literally was my consciousness. Then after that experience faded, I thought, if this was a true experience, it should be written about by the mystics. So I was at a experimental college in Vermont where I could study whatever I wanted with no course requirements or grades. So I studied mysticism, and I found in many religious mystic traditions describing different languages this oneness. For example, in some Greek, Neoplatonic is called Neoplatonic mysticism, going back to maybe the second or third century AD, they described the one and the many, that there was one and many at the same time. And I found the same thing in Hindu mysticism. It talked about the one, the self of all things. And I found similar descriptions of union with God in Christian mysticism and Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism. And then I studied a little bit about Islamic mysticism or Sufism. But it was when I met my first spiritual teacher, who was a psychiatrist from Chile, who was an expert on mysticism and meditation. Okay. He said that he was starting a group in Berkeley, and he invited me to move to California and join his group. We had a combination of meditation practices from different traditions. He would read us Sufi stories. Some of these stories I later realized were from Rumi. And he invited different teachers to work with our group. He invited a Tibetan Lama, a Hasidic mystic from the Jewish tradition, and other teachers from different traditions to work with our group. And the last teacher he invited was a Sufi from England. So we felt that we wanted to study Sufism with this man, so we did. Eventually, a couple of years later, he started a school in Los Angeles, a Sufi school, and we all lived in a big mansion and had courses and did Sufi practices like zikr, which is repetition of the name of, or beautiful names of God. Very powerful spiritual practice in a group.
Yes.
And he taught us to do whirling from the whirling dervish tradition of Turkey. And my wife and I and three others would whirl on Thursday nights when he would invite people to come to the institute. He would give a lecture. We would do a zikr. And we, the five of us, would whirl. And we had whirling, makeshift whirling dervish costumes.
Okay.
The whirling has to do with concentrating on the name of God, Allah, in the heart. And I believe it's inspired by a verse from the Quran, whichever way you turn, there is the face of God. So the face of God is wherever we turn, is in our heart, is everywhere, which is a mystical understanding. So he invited, the school began in 1975, he invited a Sufi teacher of the whirling dervish tradition from Turkey to come to Los Angeles, and the man accepted. He was in his late 70s, and of the whirling dervish tradition is called Mevlevi, having to do with Mevlana or Maulana Jalaluddin Rumi. So he came and he taught us the whirling dervish ritual. He initiated myself and my wife as whirling dervishes. And in preparation for his visit, I spent many months reading the complete English translation of his rhymed couplets, or Masnavi, these collection of what I'm describing as Sufi stories. I read that, all six books, in preparation for the Sheikh's visit. And I felt that this was the greatest work that I had ever discovered of religious mysticism. And then so the teacher came in 1976. The next year, my wife and I went to Turkey and visited him in Konya, and we went to Rumi's tomb in Konya, which is now a museum, where he's buried next to his father and his son and his companions and other descendants. And my wife also had the extraordinary experience of feeling this presence of holiness, which was standing in before his tomb. That was amazing. It affected our consciousness. It felt like what I call the perfume of love. And I never experienced anything like that, any experience of holiness at a particular place like that.
So powerful, yes.
So we've been involved in the Whirling Dervish or Mevlevi tradition ever since. And a few years later, I felt so affected and wanting to go deeper into this tradition that I began teaching myself classical or medieval Persian so I could read Rumi in the original.
Wow, that's quite an undertaking to jump straight into.
And then I was just studying on my own, and I found and heard that a new teacher was coming to the University of Berkeley at California, and he was from Afghanistan, and he was going to be teaching Persian literature. And I introduced myself to him, and I asked him to help me with some quatrains that I had some difficulty with. And he said, let's translate all of them. So that's what took us 22 years. Longer than we dreamed. But he turned out to be, in effect, my teacher. To taught me how to translate. At the time, his English was not very good, and my Persian was intermediate at best. Yeah. So we balanced each other quite nicely.
Exactly. Now, one thing you should explain, obviously, Sufi is an order of Islam, you know, like Shia and Sunni. Can you explain the difference so people can understand?
It's really not a branch or sect of Islam. It's it permeates Islam. It's just the mystical dimension of Islam. So you have Sufi mystics. They could be Shia, they could be Sunni, and they could be more westernized, or they could be very traditional and conservative. But they're focusing on an inner level of Islam, a deeper level, an experiential level that hopefully goes beyond the mind. And that is, in fact, how I define mysticism as spiritual experience that goes beyond the ordinary mind, beyond the ordinary mental concepts and thoughts that we have.
Now, in translating that poetry, how different is Persian poetry to Western poetry, the format and how it's done, and the rhyming and the pacing? How different is it?
Well, I'm not an expert on English literature and poetry, and so I can't explain it in those terms. But Persian is an Indo-European language, so there are similarities. Madar is mother, Pedar is father, Baradar is brother, and so it's related to English in a number of ways. And the what can I say about the rhymes? There are different rhyme schemes in Persian poetry, and I'll get into that when I share some examples of Rumi's poetry in Persian.
Okay, would you like to do one that now to give an example?
I would like to read the quatrain that is on the cover of the Quatrains of Rumi, the book that I did with Dr. Farhadi, and this quatrain is on the front cover in Persian calligraphy and in English, and our translation is as follows. The one who passes by my tomb will become spiritually drunk, and if he stops there, he will become drunk forever. If he goes to the ocean, the ocean and ship's masts will become drunk. And if he goes into the earth, his grave and burial niche will become drunk.
Hmm.
This is a very special poem to me, and that's the reason that I put it on the cover. And it relates to my experiences going to Rumi's tomb and having my consciousness change as if drunk.
Really, using that term drunk as a totally out of normal yeah. condition.
Well, I added the word spiritually drunk so that there'd be no confusion.
Okay, yeah.
And then I have a melody that I sing quatrains in to help me go deeper into it. And the quatrain, the first, second, and fourth lines rhyme. The third doesn't have to rhyme, so it gives the poet some freedom there.
Okay.
And the rhythm is da 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 da. Bergure manon ku gozerad mas shawad. Daris kunad to bea bad mas shawad. Dar bahrawad bahro amad mas shawad. Dar chokravad guru lahad mas shawad. So you see the rhymes, mas shawad, gozarad mas shawad, ba'abad mas shawad, wala olahad mas shawad. So that's how the quatrains rhyme. I'll read a few other examples from the book. Love is the path and road of our prophet. We were born from love, and love was our mother. O you who are our mother, you are hidden within veils, concealed from our rejecting nature. And then, today, like every day, we are ruined, ruined by wine. Don't open the door of worry, but take up the vial. There are 100 kinds of prayer, bowing, and prostrations for the one whose prayer niche is the beauty of the beloved. This is a special quatrain because it means that when he says there are 100 kinds of prayer, it means no matter what you're doing during the day, you can be in the remembrance of God. You can remember the beauty of the beloved. As the Sufis refer to God as the divine beloved, and the Sufi refers to him or herself as the lover.
Oh, interesting.
This poem, by the way, was made into a very popularized version, where by Coleman Barks, is a very gifted American poet, and he changed the quatrain quite a lot to make it more accessible in his way. He rendered it, "Let the beauty we love be what we do. There are 100 ways to kneel and kiss the ground." You see, he thought maybe the Islamic element was maybe, in the way Islam is misunderstood in America, might be less attractive, so he kind of changed it a little bit. But I think the original is far more profound. There are 100 kinds of prayer, bowing, and prostration for the one whose prayer niche or prayer direction is the beauty of the beloved. I just think it's more substantial, more religiously mystical.
I agree. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely lost a lot. Now, his Coleman Barks' works are quite popular. They really helped popularize Rumi in America a lot, I understand.
His work or his interpretations are probably the single most factor that has made Rumi so popular. There you see his versions on gift cards and all kinds of calendars and Rumi calendars and...
Yeah.
I see his versions, and it doesn't sound like Rumi, but the remarkable thing is that it has spread the fame of Rumi.
Right, that's it. Is it better to get something out that's approximating it than nothing, I suppose?
Yes. Well, I basically have a positive attitude that for my work, the more people that are that have heard or have enthusiasm about Rumi, the more that then there will be correspondingly a greater percentage of those who want to go deeper. Hmm. Those are the people that I'm hoping to connect with through my website and through my books.
Right. Interesting. Okay. The next step, basically, yeah, beyond the introduction.
Yes. Yeah. The website, which I'll mention, is daralmasnavi.org, daralmasnavi.org. Can be found through just a search on Masnavi, Masnavi. And that's my website that I've been working on for the last 9 years.
Yeah. No, it's beautiful. You've done some incredible work. It's fabulous.
Thank you.
Now, one thing, an interesting phrase I saw reading up here in Wikipedia and stuff was imaginative enchantment was mentioned. Where Rumi invites his readers to fall into imaginative enchantment. Is that... I love that phrase.
That's new to me, but my own experience is that I fall in love with his imagery. Hmm. He has imagery of it's just so truly enchanting. Hmm. A standard imagery that was used by Persian poets centuries before him, but the way he does it is special. For example, the especially themes of the lover and the beloved. Mm. The nightingale is depicted as the lover of the rose, and the nightingale is in love with the rose and is singing passionately to the beautiful beloved rose. And many images like that.
Mm. Oh, interesting. Yeah, it's so. It's the beauty of the imagery that takes you.
Yes, another one is the image of the moth and the candle flame. The moth is the lover circling around the candle flame, and the only way to attain union is to die.
Mm.
So that's a profound mystic symbol.
Oh, okay. Now I know it seems that. I've read a number of things where people really take a very broad look at what Rumi wrote in terms of their interpretation, you know, almost from the sacred to the profane.
Yes.
It's interesting how differently people see it and perceive it.
Yes, that's true. I view that in historical terms. For example... people learned over 100 years ago that they could study or practice different forms of yoga without being involved with Hindu temples or Hindu priests or Hindu religion. The same for Buddhism. People could practice Zen meditation or Vipassana or Southern Buddhism without being involved with a Buddhist priest or temple. And the same thing with Islamic mysticism. That people could practice Sufi exercises, spiritual practices, read Sufi poetry, be involved with different Sufi traditions without being directly involved with going to a mosque or converting to Islam. And it's an entry way. Mm. So in a similar way, that's how I understand Rumi's popularization. That the different most popular books minimize Rumi as a Muslim and maximize him as an ecstatic.
Okay.
Yeah.
The emphasis, yeah.
And I think that's okay because that's what makes this form of mysticism, which is one of the most beautiful mysticisms in the world, makes it attractive and more accessible to people.
Now, one thing I was reading, you're talking about Turkey, and I was reading that actually Sufism is actually banned in Turkey, or...
Yes, that was the thing that was especially... it was devastating to all Sufi traditions in Turkey, but especially to ours, because our tradition was dependent on whirling halls for the whirlings... the whirling dervish ritual. And so all of the buildings were confiscated. Hmm. all Sufi organizations were declared illegal in 1925. And this was because of the Turkish Republic's determination to get out of what they viewed as a backward medieval type of culture and be competitive with European culture.
Hmm.
So they wanted to advance, and they felt that the Dervish traditions were keeping Turkey backward, so they just made them illegal.
Huh.
It was very devastating to our tradition.
Yes, with Rumi buried there in Turkey, that really that's a significant banning. Yeah.
So his tomb was turned into a museum, and the whirling prayer ceremony, the whirling dervish ritual, had been banned from almost 30 years, but in 1953 it was allowed to be done for the first time, for the sake of tourism.
Hmm.
Attracting tourists from other countries and within Turkey as well to come to Konya. And then over the years, it's become a bigger and bigger festival. I went for the first time this December, a few weeks ago, to see the big whirling dervish ceremony in a big, giant whirling stadium that seated several thousand. And it was it's become a big stage event because originally it was the zikr, or just the remembrance of God ritual in our tradition was done in private whirling halls.
Mm.
And now it's only done on stages.
Mm.
And it's pretty much controlled by the Turkish government to promote Turkish culture and tourism. And it's enabled our tradition to continue this ritual instead of it just being completely banned,
right.
But it's become very form oriented and
stylized.
Yes,
in that way.
Yeah.
Hmm. Well, interesting. Well, we are. I'm interviewing Ibrahim Gamard, and this is Arnold, your host of Tommy's Holiday Camp, and we're talking about Rumi. And Ibrahim is a scholar and translator of Rumi. Perhaps would you like to recite something else?
I'd be glad to.
That would be lovely.
I'd like to read, this is 18 verses. I'll read them in English and then just a few of the ones in Persian so the listeners can get a sense of the rhyme and the melody I use. But this is the beginning 18 lines of his greatest work. And it's about the reed flute complaining. And the reed flute is complaining that it was cut from its reed bed. And it yearns to return to its reed bed. This is a symbol of the mystic, of the soul of the mystic, who experiences separation from the source and is yearning to return. And for that reason, the reed flute is especially significant in our tradition, because the reed flute symbolizes that part of the reed that was cut off and made into a flute. And these 18 lines are about the complaint of the reed flute. Listen to the reed flute, how it is complaining. It is telling about separations, saying, ever since I was severed from the reed field, men and women have lamented in the presence of my shrill cries. But I want a heart which is torn, torn from separation, so that I may explain the pain of yearning. Anyone who remained far from his roots seeks a return to the time of his union. I lamented in every gathering I associated with those in bad or happy circumstances. But everyone became my friend from his own opinion. He did not seek my secrets from within me. My secret is not far from my lament, but eyes and ears do not have the light to sense it. The body is not hidden from the soul, nor the soul from the body, but seeing the soul is not permitted. The reed's cry is fire, it is not wind. Whoever doesn't have this fire, may he be nothing. It is the fire of love that fell into the reed flute. It is the ferment of love that fell into the wine. The reed flute is the companion of anyone who is severed from a friend. Its melodies tore our veils. Who has seen a poison and a remedy like the reed? Who has seen a harmonious companion and a yearning friend like the reed? The reed is telling the story of the path full of blood. It is telling stories of the crazed Majnun's love. There is no confidant of this understanding except the senseless. There is no purchaser of that tongue except the ear of the mystic. In our longing, the days became like evenings. The days became fellow travelers with burning fevers. If the days have passed, tell them to go and don't worry. But you remain, O you, whom no one resembles in purity. Everyone becomes satiated by water except the fish, and everyone who is without daily food finds that his days become long. None who is raw can understand the state of the ripe. Therefore, this speech must be shortened. So farewell. And this is a rhymed couplet, so each half rhymes separately, and then the next line is a different rhyme, and the rhythm is da 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 da. I'll just read the first five lines in the melody that I use. Bish now in a chun shikoyat me kunad. As to doi ho hikoyat me kunad. Kaz ne istan ta merobu brida and. Dar nefir amardos an olida and. Sin choham sharhe sharhe as ferog. Ta beguyam sharhe darde eshti yog. Har kesi kudur mondaz aslechish. Boz juyad rozegore waslechish. Anyone who remained far from his roots seeks a return to the time of his union. Mm. So there's some, maybe 18,000 of these couplets in his great masterpiece. Yeah.
Wow. That's amazing to be able to be so prolific.
Yeah.
That is phenomenal to have that opportunity. Now, a lot of his work... I understand it's taken from stories, from the Quran, from all different. What was those influences that he built into his work?
Well, he composed his masterpiece, the Masnavi, toward the end of his life, mainly to teach his disciples, and very common in Persian poetry. Great or deep wisdom is rhymed so that people can memorize it easier. Mm. So he wrote it out of devotion to his students, and more than that, of course, for the world. Mm-hmm. And he heard these Sufi stories and stories from the Quran and other traditions all his life, and many from his teachers. And he chose the ones that he thought could communicate to different readers or listeners, from very simple stories about human folly that are oftentimes quite humorous to very deep, profound experiences experienced by the characters in his stories but believed to be his own spiritual experiences that are extraordinary.
And did he bring in other than Islamic influences into those stories? Was he really broad in that concept? Or
no, contrary to popular opinion or popular views, I have not found any evidence that he knew about other religions any more than he learned in his Islamic education. Hmm. But people would like to believe that he was knowledgeable about other religions and was open to having disciples of all religions, but I didn't find that to be so in the original documents, texts.
Now, in your research, did you go back to literally the original? Are there the original texts still available? What he and his disciples have wrote down, or are they?
Well, his disciples wrote down his poems as he recited them, and there are very early manuscripts, and there are very late manuscripts where many poems and lines and changes have been added by scribes over the centuries. That's why it's important to rely for translation on the earliest manuscripts.
Did you have access to those?
Printed in modern typography in Iran, yes, but certainly based on the earliest texts and earliest manuscripts.
Are they in his museum? Those original texts, are they scattered around the world?
They're scattered. Yeah. Most of them are in Turkey in different museums, in Istanbul and Konya. Others are in the British Museum and elsewhere.
In Persia, in Iran, how do they look on Rumi and Sufism?
Well, Rumi is very revered in Iran and, for centuries, and always has been considered one of the greatest Persian poets of all time. Of the famous Persian poets, Attar, Sana'i, and others, were Sunni Persian poets. So when Iran converted to Shiism, they still continued to love those earlier poets, even though they were Sunni mystic poets. They continue to revere them down to this day.
That's good. Often that's when something's overlaid, the old stuff's expunged. So that's lucky it did. That did happen.
Yes. Because wisdom is wisdom, and how can you not love wisdom?
Well, I wish a lot more people would have that belief. It seems, look what we had just a few years ago in Afghanistan, where they were blowing up all those beautiful monuments for a while there.
Yes.
You know, that's a rejection of what went before.
Correct.
Yeah, that's...
fanaticism in all cultures, unfortunately.
Right, exactly. You traveled and you just came back from Turkey.
Yes, I've made 11 trips to Turkey in the last 7 years. Yeah. I was going twice a year to visit my whirling dervish friends in Istanbul and Konya. And also to see what was left of the whirling dervish tradition in Turkey, due to the illegality situation.
So it's being done in this government-approved, stylized way, but there's also other groups then who are doing it as and when they would.
Discreetly, yes.
Discreetly, yeah. Yeah, I know when I was in Egypt, the only whirling dervish exhibit was a government-run one. I remember that.
It wasn't...
I didn't see it anywhere else.
In Cairo.
At the Citadel there, I think it was. Mm-hmm. But I did get to go to like a zikir, a mulid, which was just one of the most amazing experiences. Just the intensity as the music kept, the repetition and the build-up and how people reacted and acted to it. It was just a phenomenal experience.
To be in a group where people are praying with such concentration together, yes, I agree.
Yeah. And... do you still whirl? Are you still whirl yourself?
Not as much as I did, but I had the opportunity to whirl with the whirling dervishes of our order in Turkey on a number of times.
And do you do any here? Do you do any classes or anything like that? When you're here,
I was involved in co-teaching with some friends in Berkeley for a number of years, whirling classes, but not in the last number of years.
Would you like to read something else?
Yes, I'd like to read one of Rumi's, what would be called lyric poems that I earlier called ecstatic poems, but lyric poems is more accurate. Hmm. And this is very, very deep, and I hope the listeners will appreciate it. How much longer will you travel backwards? Don't go into unbelief and denial, but come to true religion. See the sweet drink within the poison, and come to the poison. Come at last to the source of your own self. Even though you are of the earth in form, still you are the fine spiritual thread made of the very substance of certainty. You are the trusted guardian of the treasury of the light of God. Come at last to the source of your own self. Know that when you have bound yourself to selflessness, you will escape from attachment to selfness. And then you will leap away from the bonds of 1,000 traps. Come at last to the source of your own self. You were born from the generation of Adam, who was an appointed deputy of God, yet you have opened an eye to this base world. How sad that you are happy with only this amount for yourself. Come at last to the source of your own self. Although you are the protecting spell which guards the treasures of this world, you are a mine of heavenly jewels within yourself. Open your two hidden eyes. Come at last to the source of your own self. Since you have been born from the ray of the majesty of God, and you are born with a fortunate rising sign of good omen, how much longer will you groan and wail about every non-existent worldly thing? Come at last to the source of your own self. You are a ruby in the middle of a granite rock. How much longer will you deceive us? The truth is apparent within your eyes, O friend. Come at last to the source of your own self. When you came from the side of that proud beloved, you came in a drunken, kind, and heart-attracted state. You also came with joyous eyes and full of the fire of love. Come at last to the source of your own self. Shamsi Tabriz, the king and cupbearer, has been holding the cup of everlasting life before you. Glory be to God, what excellent pure wine. Come at last to the source of your own self.
Nice, because, yeah, it's really individual rather than, as you say, going for the whole. It really goes deep into the one, isn't it?
Yes.
It's interesting, yes.
Well said. Mm. The rhythm of this is da 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 da. I'll just read the first few lines with the melody I use. Ta chanda to pas rawi be pisha, der kufr marau besoi kisha, der nisha to nusha bin benisha, acher to be asle chisha, acher to be asle chisha, her chanda besura te zemini, pas rishte gau heri yakini, per mechzani. Nure hak amini acher tobe asle asle chisha. And I get groups of people that would come to the classes to sing this refrain. I turn this into a refrain so people could have the experience of singing in Persian along with Rumi at least the refrain.
Mm-hmm.
So the refrain is Acher tobe asle asle chisha, acher tobe asle asle chisha. Come to the source of your own self.
Hmm.
So that's one of his most beautiful lyric ecstatic poems.
That's beautiful. And what's interesting, I was reading that it really has been a family guardian. There has been a continuous passing down of Rumi's lineage through this whole process, I understand. And there still are his descendants are still involved.
Yes.
That's 700 years and counting.
Well, part of the reason of that is that the leader of our Sufi order was always a direct descendant, a male lineal descendant of Rumi. And the current leader is now the 23rd generation descendant of Rumi, and his name is Faruk Çelebi. He lives in Istanbul. I've met him many times, and in fact, he initiated me as a teacher in our tradition a few years ago. And he is the only one that has the authority to initiate sheikhs or spiritual teachers or guides in our Sufi tradition. And that's one reason that our tradition has held been intact for so long, because it was always unified under one leader, of the descendant of Rumi. And he's the 33rd, what we call Chief Çelebi. The family of Rumi is called the Çelebi family. And the leader of the order is called the Chief Çelebi. And he's the 33rd one.
Wow.
And then hopefully one of his sons will succeed him.
Oh, that is incredible. And living in a country which sort of bans them as well, that's a strange juxtaposition paradox there, isn't it? Having to battle that.
Well, as long as the Çelebi family doesn't directly promote a Sufi organization in Turkey, they're okay.
Okay.
In fact, the country of Turkey is rather proud of the Çelebi family for cultural reasons.
Do they ever leave? Do they ever? Does he ever leave and leave Turkey? Or
sure, he does. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Sometimes he goes with the whirling dervishes when they travel to other countries to perform.
And so, do people? Obviously, people come to see him. Apart from the dervishes, does it have that type of draw amongst?
He tries to avoid that role, because that's maybe perhaps tending toward an organizational tendency of some kind. He's very discreet. Yes.
Okay. Understand. Well, we're coming up to the last couple of minutes, actually, of the show.
Okay.
Would you like? Please give your website and information out again. But if there's something else you'd like to sing or recite, that would be really good.
Yes. Well, again, my name is Ibrahim Gamar, G-A-M-A-R-D. My website is daralmasnavi.org. Do a search on Masnavi, M-A-S-N-A-V-I. And my last name, Gamar, G-A-M-A-R-D. I have one other poem. Go and tell that lute player, the mystic drunkards are giving their greetings of peace to you. And tell the water bird, the mystic drunkards are giving their greetings of peace to you, their salams. And tell that prince of the cupbearers, the mystic drunkards are giving their greetings. O soul of the soul, O soul of the soul, the mystic drunkards are giving their greetings of peace to you. And in Persian, it has some internal rhyme. I'll sing a few lines of it. Rawan rebabi, rawbigu, mastan salamat meykunand. Giving their salams, their greetings of peace, their salam. Wan morge abi, rawbigu, Mastan selamet mekunen, wan mirisaki rabigu, mastan selamet mekunen, wan umre baki rabigu, mastan selamet mekunen, wan miri gaugau rabigu, mastan selamet mekunen, wan shoro saudau rabigu, mastan selamet mekunen, e masi rukhsar at kejil, mastan selamet mekunen, we rahedo o ram Medil, Mastan Salamet, Mekunet, hey Johnny Johnny, Johnny John, Mastan Salamet, Mekunet, hey Arzu, hey Arzu, Mastan Salamet, Mekunet, on Perde Robert Dorzu, Mastan Salamet, Mekunet.
Oh,
so you can see how joyous it is, and it's referring to a state of spiritual drunkenness and joy.
Yeah, what a refreshing difference. Yeah, it's not top heavy. It seems that's the nice thing. It's from within,
and that comes through in the original. And when it's translated, it can maybe sound a little bit too academic or something. But it's very beautiful and joyous at times. Yeah.
Well, I can see why you were attracted to it, and you've spent your life working and being with it and in it. It's fabulous. Well, thank you, Ibrahim, for coming in and sharing.
You're quite welcome. Yeah.
I really appreciate it, and perhaps you can come in again. I'd love to hear some more about it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ibrahim.